for your reading. Kind of extraordinary, really, that this comes the day after the coronation, isn't it? Because there's so many echoes, really, in terms of the whole business about leadership and what that is, and we'll explore that a little bit as we go on. There was reference in our household, where we had our grandchildren staying over the last couple of days, to the king's chlorination. So you can be assured that he's well disinfected. What we're doing today is we're starting on this series in Exodus, and for the next 6 weeks or so, we'll take a break for Pentecost, but we're going to be looking through the book of Exodus, and we're going to do that alongside the focus group. So if you're in a focus group, then you'll know what the deal is. If you would like to be in a focus group and you're not, then the person to speak to is Martin, who's going to stand up and wave. Thank you very much. There you go. So if you are not in a focus group at present and you're interested, then please speak to Martin. There are a number of focus groups right through the town, meeting on different days of the week. And over these next 6 weeks or so, we're going to be thinking about this book of Exodus. And it's a really important book, actually, in terms of understanding the Bible as a whole. On the notes, I've suggested that a good background is available at this website. So this is really just for your kind of advance information before you come to the groups if you want to have a look at it. BibleProject.com, and they have a whole series of very short videos, usually 5 minutes, on different books of the Bible. And I think they're very good, and they give a lot of background information. And I thought what I would do is I'm going to show you about 2.5 minutes of the video about Exodus, so you just get an idea what the kind of style is and what the information is.
The book of Exodus. It's the second book of the Bible, and it picks up the storyline from the previous book, Genesis, which ended with Abraham's grandson, Jacob, leading his large family of 70 people down to Egypt. Now, Jacob's 11th son, Joseph, had been elevated to second in command over Egypt, and he had saved his whole family in a famine. And so Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, offered the family to come live there as a safe haven. And so eventually Jacob dies there in Egypt, and Joseph and all his brothers do too. About 400 years pass, and the story of the Exodus begins. Now, that name refers to the event that takes place in the first half of the book, Israel's exodus from Egypt. But the book has a second half that takes place at the foot of Mount Sinai. In this video, we'll just focus on the first half, where centuries have passed, and the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied, and they filled the land. Now, this line is a deliberate echo back to the blessing that God gave all humanity back in the Garden of Eden. And it reminds us of the big biblical story so far. Humanity forfeited God's blessing through sin and rebellion, and so God chose Abraham's family as the vehicle through which he would restore his blessing to all the world. But the new Pharaoh does not view Israel as a blessing. He actually thinks this growing Israelite immigrant group is a threat to his power. And so just as in Genesis, humanity rebels against God's blessing, so here, Pharaoh attempts to destroy the source of God's blessing, the Israelites. He brutally enslaves them in forced labor, and then he orders that all the Israelite boys be drowned in the Nile River. Now, Pharaoh, he is the worst character in the Bible so far. His kingdom epitomizes humanity's rebellion against God. Pharaoh has so redefined good and evil according to his own interests that even the murder of innocent children has become good to him. And so Egypt has become worse than Babylon from the book of Genesis. And so now Israel cries out for help against this new Babylon, and God responds. God first turns Pharaoh's evil upside down, as an Israelite mother throws her boy into the Nile River, but in a basket. And so he floats safely right down into Pharaoh's own family. He's named Moses, and he grows up to eventually become the man that God will use to defeat Pharaoh's evil. In the famous story of the burning bush, God appears to Moses and commissions him to go to Pharaoh and order him to release the Israelites. And God says that he knows Pharaoh will resist, and so he will bring his judgment on Egypt in the form of plagues. Then God also says that he will harden Pharaoh's heart.
Okay, you'll have to look at yourself to get the next bit of the story. But I just give you an idea that the kind of style and what's there. I mean, I recommend those to you. They're very short, there's a lot of information there. But I wanted to turn from what is really, that's a kind of overview of the whole book of Exodus, to this more specific passage in chapter 3 that Alan read, the incident of the burning bush. But here's a question for you. What do these people have in common? What do they have in common? They're all leaders. Anything else? They're all rich. Well, I don't know about Moses so much. But one of the things I thought was quite interesting about this is that all of these people were into their eighth decade by the time they took on significant leadership responsibility. King Charles, I think, is 74. Is that right? Trump was 71 when he was first elected in 2017. Biden was 79 when he took office. And Moses, well, it's a little bit less clear for Moses, but in Exodus 7, when Moses is confronting Pharaoh, we're told that at the time that Moses confronted Pharaoh, he was 80. So at this stage of the story, which is slightly before that, he's maybe a little younger than 80. So these people all took on leadership in their eighth decade. That's pretty extraordinary, isn't it? And I think one of the things for me that it does is it begs this question: what is leadership? Clearly, it's not something that is limited by age. So what is it? And in particular, what is godly leadership? What does that look like? And I think I want to suggest that although, you know, for the presidents and kings and prophets and so on, we think of leadership at the kind of high end of the thing, I think godly leadership, I mean, although it is exercised in those ways, most often is exercised at a much lower level, if you like. I think that any way in which we influence others can be called godly leadership. Any ways in which our lives intersect with other people and we demonstrate something that makes a difference in their lives can be called godly leadership. So it includes presidents and kings and ministers and elders, but if you're a parent or a grandparent, if you're an uncle or an aunt, in your relationships at work, in your relationships at leisure, what you will be doing in your behavior is setting out an alternative way that others may choose to look at and even to follow. And in that way, I think godly leadership is exercised in all sorts of different ways. So I want to look at this idea of godly leadership. And first of all, from God's side, what is it that God was doing? And then secondly, what it is that Moses is doing. From God's side, there are two critical things about leadership. And they are that Moses was called and Moses was equipped. And I think that's common to all areas of godly leadership. Moses is clearly being called by God in this passage, isn't he? God calls out of the burning bush and made Moses listen to that call. So Moses listens to God's call, and as a result of that, everything changes for Moses. If he hadn't listened to the call, he would have just gone on being a shepherd in the land of Midian. But God called, and Moses listened. Why is it important for godly leaders to know that God called them? Even Jesus seemed to, there was a sense in which Jesus needed to know very clearly that God had called. And there are two occasions in the Gospels. There's one at his baptism and there's one at the Transfiguration where God speaks and says, "This is my son." He doesn't actually use the word call, but that's the implication. This is my son. Listen to him. So why is it important for godly leaders to have that sense that God called them? Why do we need that? Why did Moses need it? Why did Jesus need it? Why do godly leaders in every generation need to be sure of that? Well, I think there's at least two reasons. One is that we tend to be a bit vain about things. We often give ourselves airs and graces that we don't really deserve. And having an overinflated view of ourselves is not a sufficient qualification for godly leadership. That won't cut the mustard. It needs to be a calling from God. But the second, and perhaps even more important reason, is this, that leadership is tough. Whether it's the formal leadership of presidents and kings and prophets, or the informal leadership of parents and grandparents and friends and relatives, leadership is tough. It's always going to be tough. And when the going gets tough, we need to have something objective to go back to and say, I'm doing this despite the fact it's tough because God's called me to do it. And I think that's really important. When I was in full-time ministry, before I retired, I used to have a thing up in my study that, and it was just about, I can't remember exactly what, there were three sentences on it. These are my priorities in ministry. And the first thing it said on there is, God's called me. And I went back to that again and again and again, I tell you. Because when things are tough, you need to have that reference point. I'm not doing this because I enjoy it particularly, or because anybody else is enjoying it just at the moment, but because God called me to do it, that's why I'm doing it. And I think that's a really important focus for us. One of the promises that God makes to Moses in this passage in verse 12 is, I will be with you. When the going gets tough, and it will, when Pharaoh is stubborn, and he will be, when the people are fractious and resent your leadership, and they will, I will be with you. I have called you. Remember that. And I think that this is necessary in every level of leadership. God calls us into the responsibilities that we carry. So how do you know what God has called you to? Well, my rule of thumb is this. What I am doing now is what God has called me to, and I will be obedient to that present call until he calls me to something different. And if he doesn't call me to something different, then I will carry on doing what I'm doing now because this is God's call now in my life. How do I know that? Well, really, because God is the good shepherd. And the task of the good shepherd is to bring the sheep to where he wants them. So I trust that God has brought me to the place that he wants me to be, and until he calls me somewhere different, this is where he's called me to be. And this is what he's called me to do. So that's what I would say. I trust that this is where God wants me. I am in the place that he wants me. I am called to this place. And until he calls me to somewhere different, I will serve. That's my task. So they're called. Second thing is that they're equipped. The main part of this in terms of Exodus is actually in the next chapter. It's in chapter 4. God gives Moses various miraculous signs. You can read those for yourselves. The staff that becomes a snake, the diseased hand that is restored, the pouring out of water that then becomes blood. And God also gives him his brother Aaron as a companion and his spokesperson. So there are various ways in which God equips Moses. The call of God on our lives is backed by his equipping. You know, I'm really sorry in a sense that I missed Hilary McDougall last week. We had a nice time away, thank you very much for asking. But I'm sorry that I missed her. because I watched it online, and actually I thought she was great. I thought she was excellent. And one of the things that really struck me about it was how clear and confident and able she was in leading worship, and how challenging, actually, what she said was. And I thought back, well, tried to think back, 22 years ago, you know, when she was here as a student. And I remember thinking then, I'm clear that Hillary has a call from God in terms of this particular area of work. And now what I see is God's equipped her. He's not only called her, he's equipped her to do the job that he originally called her to do. And that's what she's getting on and doing. So when God calls leaders, God equips them. And that's not, by the way, just for ministers or elders or session clerks. It's for everybody. It's for accountants and teachers and lawyers and nurses and farmers and grandparents and football coaches. Whatever your area of leadership, when God calls you to something, God equips you to do that task. And actually, that's one of the ways, I mean, we could go into this a lot, but that's one of the ways in which discerning a call is possible, because you have to say, okay, is this person called to do this? Well, are they equipped to do it? And if the answer to that is clearly not, then maybe that's not the area that God is calling them into. So, God's call, God's equipping. I think, though, that's from Moses' side. By the way, I just want to say that the other way of stating that in terms of, you know, God calls and equips is this, that our inadequacy never defeats God's call, because God will equip us. So it's just, you know, it's not good enough from God's point of view to say, no, I can't do that, God, I'm not good enough for it. So God says, okay, well, I'll make you good enough for it then. I'll equip you to do it. Our sense of inadequacy is never defeats God's call. Let's think about it from Moses' point of view, just quite quickly. Some interesting contrasts here, curiosity and not contentedness. I'm thinking here about the qualities that Moses demonstrates in terms of his leadership, curiosity and not contentedness. I don't think those are necessarily opposites, by the way. I think you can probably be contented and curious at the same time. But my point really is that when Moses saw the burning bush, he said to himself, I'm going to go over there and have a look and see what's going on over there. What's happening? That's a really good question for leaders. What's happening? And the other really good question for leaders is, what if? What if we did it differently? What if we had a different song at the beginning of the service? What if we had a different structure within our presbytery? What if? And that kind of curiosity is really important in leaders. And in some sense, it's contrasted with contentedness, because contentedness says, we're just marvelous, you know. Aren't we good? No, you're not. Well, yes, you are. But there's more. That's the point. There's more. And actually, godly leaders always know that. There's more. And so if we settle down too much, then we're not in the right place. We need to maintain that curiosity. Humility and not power. This is a huge one, isn't it? I was interested, I didn't see very much of the coronation yesterday, but I was interested that somebody was telling me that at the beginning of the service, as Charles comes in, the page boy says, why are you here? It's kind of an obvious question, really. I mean, you know, just that we've been planning this for the last 75 years, but no. Why are you here? I'm not here to be served. I'm here to serve. But the difficulty, of course, with this is that in worldly terms, most often we think of leadership in terms of the exercise of power. Power to control, power to shape the lives of others, whether they like it or not. That saying that's attributed to the British politician Lord Acton, power corrupts, And absolute power corrupts absolutely. And, you know, the reason I think that is sticks in the mind is you can see that played out, can't you? You can see it the way it works, not only in the history of our own land, but in current world affairs. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. It just takes away the trueness of mind. And that is not what godly leadership is about. Godly leadership is not about power, it is about humility. When God outlined to Moses in this passage what he wanted him to do, Moses, what did Moses say? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and say, let my people go? And of course, we have the teaching of Jesus and his example to guide us in Matthew chapter 20, when James and John are trying to bargain for the best places in the kingdom of heaven. Jesus says to them, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. And that's the way that godly authority, godly leadership is exercised, in humility rather than in power. And the last one is simply this: obedience and not... Actually, that's, I've written that slide wrong. It should say obedience, not comfort. The perils of doing these things late at night. It should say obedience and not comfort. For all Moses' reluctance and for all his excuses and his attempt to deflect God's call, in the end, he went. In the end, when he returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, he said to Jethro, I've got to go to Egypt. Why did he say that? Because he was prepared to be obedient and not just comfortable. And in fact, God told him, as Miriam highlighted, it's not going to be comfortable, because I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart, and you're not going to have an easy time of it, Moses. But Moses was still willing to be obedient. There's an interesting passage, you know, in Matthew 8, in the story of the centurion's servant, where Jesus is asked to go and heal the centurion's servant. And when he gets to speak to the centurion, do you remember what he says? He says, I too am a man under authority. That's interesting, isn't it? That Jesus says that. That for Jesus, it was just also about obedience. Obedience to his Father's will, not being comfortable. And for Jesus, that obedience took him all the way to his death, even his death on the cross. And sometimes godly leadership takes us to places we would rather not be. And with comfort having been abandoned, we find ourselves in difficult situations. But that's where sometimes it can take us, and certainly that's where it took Moses. Let us pray.